Wonderful to be with each and every one of you this morning, especially our visitors. We want you to know you're honored guests and love to see you back at any opportunity you might have. If you're traveling, we'll pray for your safety, and we're glad that you're here with us this morning to worship God. Worship has been, for me, very edifying and encouraging, beneficial this morning. I hope it has been the same for you as we worship God in spirit and in truth, and I hope that the lesson this morning is likewise beneficial to you. I'd ask you to follow along the scriptures with me this morning and establish the truth. Obey God, not men. And if the things that have to be said here this morning are in accordance with God's word, I encourage you to make those applications and change your life by them. This morning, I kind of struggled with the sermon in regard to its title. I've titled it God, Kings, and the King. And if we just thought about that title, you might think that we're going to be studying the sovereignty of God. That would be a good topic and probably a more fitting title for that lesson than the lesson we have today. But I hope that as we go throughout this lesson, the title starts to make more and more sense. Essentially, what we're going to be doing is it's considering a brief survey of a large part of the Old Testament history, a very significant part. And learning from that, we know that the Old Testament is written for our learning, and it is chock full of examples, the good, the bad, and the ugly. God spares no detail that would benefit us, whether it would be positive or negative. And we can learn a lot from the mistakes of God's people in ancient times, and then in the New Testament ancient times, and then even learn from each other's examples today as we seek to live for God and learn from the mistakes of others, learn from the successes of others. And that's what we're going to do this morning, is consider some very grave mistakes made by God's people. In a real general way, we need to learn from those. And ultimately, I think that any kind of example in the Old Testament, it obviously can teach some specific principles. But any example in the Old Testament, good or bad, really gives us the understanding and sets us up to acknowledge that man fully depends upon God for provision, for protection, and ultimately, of course, for salvation. And so what I attempt to do in this morning's lesson is ultimately to learn from the inspired history of Israel's grave mistake of rejecting God and demanding that a king be put in place for them and placing their trust for wisdom, guidance, and protection, and salvation in a physical sense, really, from that king. And then God's reaction to that and the negative outcomes from that request of the children of Israel, and then ultimately through God's providence and eternal promise and eternal provision in his plan, how he placed himself back up on that throne and how beneficial that is to us today and how we need to take advantage of it. Consider firstly when Israel in their history, early on as a nation, rejected God's original design of a theocracy, God as the king, so that they would establish something similar to the nations about them we could describe as, obviously, a monarchy. Consider in Exodus 19 in verses 3 through 6, in the Exodus and the giving of the law on Mount Sinai, God's instruction for Moses to tell them, "Thus you shall say to the house of Jacob and tell the children of Israel, you have seen what I did to the Egyptians and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you shall be a special treasure to me above all people, for all the earth is mine. And you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words which you shall speak to the children of Israel." God had just demonstrated the great deliverance from the Egyptian bondage for the Israelites. The world empire at the time, the world power, the most important people in the world in regard to the political power and the control they had, Pharaoh and his army, were completely decimated. And God did it in such a way to illustrate to the children of Israel that you can't do anything without me. And in fact, you did nothing to gain any kind of deliverance in this particular instance. We might read in the first part of Exodus chapter 3 about how God was telling Moses, or rather chapter 14 when they were actually delivered, God was telling Moses where they would be led by Moses and what that would mean for them, that they would be pretty much trapped as the Israelites or the Egyptians gathered in behind them. They would be walled in. And that would be to show them that you can't do anything without me. And then how the people trembled and were complaining. And then Moses said, stand still and see the salvation of the Lord. He delivered them that day. So after that great deliverance, God reminds them of that. Look at how I bore you on eagle's wings. I brought you to myself. I did this for you, and you couldn't have had it happen except for me on your side. And so this is what's going to happen. As long as you obey my voice, you will now be a world power. You're going to be the most significant power on the earth. And there was a time when that was the case for the children of Israel and their nation. And the reason for it was they were unlike any other nation. They were a true theocracy. And let's stress that point. There are concepts of theocracies today in today's world who claim to be governed by God. And they have physical kings, so it might be a theocratic monarchy that we're talking about. But a true theocracy is one that is truly governed by God. And that was essentially what God's intentions was for the Israelite nation. We'd come to a period of time where judges were appointed, and so there were physical men that were God's appointed people to carry out his judgments and his commands and even deliver them from oppressive regimes throughout the world. But ultimately, God, they understood God was their king. There's not a kingdom without a king. There's not a king without a kingdom. And he said, you're a holy nation, a kingdom, a priest. So God is their king. That was his intention. And they would ultimately need to continually rely upon him for provision and protection. Well, at the end of the period of judges, the perception of the children of Israel in regard to God, their king, changed drastically. In 1 Samuel chapter 8, where Samuel is one of those judges as well as a priest, he appoints his sons judges in Israel. And in verse 2, it says the name of the firstborn was Joel and the name of his second Abijah, and they were judges in Beersheba. But his sons did not walk in his ways. They turned aside after dishonest gain, took bribes, and perverted justice. Then all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah and said, look, you are old and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now make us a king to judge us like all the nations. I want us to notice that they don't say, discipline your sons that you appointed as judges because they're not acting right. And then continue this God-appointed structure of God being the king and judges being appointed to carry out his will and appoint some more judges that are going to be just with their judgments, that are going to be moral in their dealings with the children of Israel. They said, make us a king to judge. And so they're not suggesting continuing on with this same structure. They're saying, let's revamp things. I don't like this layout anymore. Samuel, it's proving to be inefficient and insufficient, so make us a king. And so it's obvious that that word judge is not used in simply with dealing with disputes, as being a judge, even in the simple way as those judges were in the period of judges. W. E. Vine comments on this particular word judge, especially as it's used in this context. The military deliverer was the head over a volunteer army summoned when danger threatened, a militia, and that was really a description of the judges, period. But in the time of Samuel, this procedure proved inadequate for Israel. They wanted a leader who would organize and lead a standing army. They asked Samuel, therefore, for a king such as the other nations had, one who was apt and trained in warfare and whose successor or son would be carefully trained too. There would be more continuity in leadership as a result, including in this idea of a king who would judge them like the other nations was the idea of a ruler. In order to sustain a permanent army in its training, the people had to be organized for taxation and conscription. Jacinius's Hebrew Chaldee lexicon defines that Hebrew word translated into judge as to rule and to govern. And essentially what those people were saying is being under God's government, obviously the judges were not acting correctly, but it was still ultimately God who's in control, and God had appointed this system of judges, and he is the head of the theocracy. This isn't good enough anymore. And so let's change things up. Let's be like the nations surrounding us. And really what this did, ultimately as it pertained to this request or demand rather for a king that would set up a standing army, a militia, showed distrust in God's protection over them. And I want us to consider that as we consider the reaction of Samuel and then God's reaction and instruction to Samuel. In 1 Samuel 8 and verse 6, this thing displeased Samuel when they said, give us a king to judge us. So Samuel prayed to the Lord, and the Lord said to Samuel, heed the voice of the people and all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me, that I should not reign over them. according to all the works which they have done since the day I brought them up out of the land of Egypt, even to this day, with which they have forsaken me and served other gods, so they are doing to you also. He doesn't say they weren't rejecting Samuel at all. He's simply stressing and emphasizing the fact that the greatest grievance that God has with them is that they rejected God. And if we go back to Deuteronomy 17, we see that I don't think God simply prophesies about the time when they would request a king, but he shows that it may be permitted, it may be useful and needful even for you to set up a king. In Deuteronomy 17 and verse 14, it says, when you come to the land which the Lord your God is giving you and possess it and dwell in it and say, I will set a king over me like all the nations are around me, you shall surely set a king over you whom the Lord your God chooses. And then he gives instructions on how that king is to be, not to abuse his power and to rule under God's control, essentially. And even then, just like in the period of Judges where men are appointed to carry out the will of God, that king would still have God on the throne and it would still be a true theocracy. And so I don't think that the problem here in 1 Samuel 8 is simply inherently that they requested a king, because it was quite obvious, even in God's eternal plan, that a king would be set up and that the Messiah would eventually come through the lineage of the second king, which we'll talk about in a minute, David. But it was the reason for their request and the attitude behind their request and the unfaithfulness behind their request. Did you notice there in 1 Samuel 8 that God pointed out that they have not rejected you, but they've rejected me? And he says, according to all the works which they have done since the day that I brought them up out of Egypt, even to this day. He reminds them, he reminds Samuel rather, of the great power that he wields and demonstrates to the children of Israel all the way back at the beginning in Exodus chapter 14. And that he reminded them of in chapter 19 when he said, these are my intentions for you. I'll be your king. You'll be my people if you obey my voice. Depend on me for the protection and provision. They said, no, I want a king. We trust more in a king to protect us with a standing army than God to protect us and deliver us. But they forget all about the fact that they didn't even have an army when they were delivered from the world power of Egypt. God did it, and he would continue to do it for them time and time again, so long as they trusted in him. And in fact, right before we read of the contents of 1 Samuel chapter 8, the children of Israel had a long-standing problem with the Philistine army. And God ended up delivering them after they learned a few lessons themselves. Consider in chapter 10 of 1 Samuel, when Samuel goes along with the command of the Lord and instruction to set up Saul as a king. When Samuel proclaimed Saul as king in 1 Samuel 10 and verse 17, Samuel called the people together to the Lord at Mizpah and said to the children of Israel, thus says the Lord God of Israel, I brought up Israel out of Egypt and delivered you from the hand of the Egyptians and from the hand of all kingdoms, and from those who oppressed you, but you have today rejected your God, who himself saved you from all your adversities and your tribulations. And you have said to him, no, set a king over us. Now therefore, present yourselves before the Lord by your tribes and by your clans. And he showed them who their king would be. It wasn't simply a request. It was a rejection of God and a display of terrible unfaithfulness. They didn't trust God anymore. They didn't trust him to provide. They didn't trust him to protect. Instead, they wanted a king, a man, to rule over them and watch over them. So God would give them, not without warning though, what they requested. In 1 Samuel 8 and verse 9, God said to Samuel, now therefore heed their voice. However, you shall solemnly forewarn them and show them the behavior of the king who will reign over them. So he told the people how this king, as one with absolute power, a monarch, would use that power to gather around that army that they so richly desire, a standing army, a militia. He would take their sons. He would take their daughters. He would take their money through taxation on top of what the law required in tithing and religious purposes. All of that had to be taken into consideration. And God points out to them how much the king would take for them. And with a man of such power and ability, what if that man abuses such and takes for himself? We read of Absalom, David's son, and when he went to usurp the throne, he decided to get some chariots and horses and men to run before him, and it was all about splendor and pomp. And so the king in his pride would have that as well. You notice the reaction that the people would have in verse 18? That hasn't happened yet, but God's saying this is what will happen. You will cry out in that day because of your king whom you have chosen for yourselves, and the Lord will not hear you in that day. He's saying, let me just forewarn you. if you go through with this request, this is what you're looking at. It's going to be hard. You're going to be taxed heavily. The king is going to take your family for his own militia and for his own palace and purposes. It's not going to be fun. And you're going to cry out to me. And so what we see is this manifestation that man's wisdom, before it's even carried out in specific application, pales in comparison to God's wisdom. It's better this way, God is saying. So don't do it. But they insisted there in verse 19. Nevertheless, the people refused to obey the voice of Samuel, and they said, no, but we will have a king over us that we may be like all the other nations. And I want us to consider this real quick. With a man of such power, what if his heart turns away from the best interest of the people? And more importantly, and related to what is in the best interests of the people, the best interest of God. What if that man does that? What's going to happen? They've set him up. They're now under his government. He is reigning over them. And what happens if he no longer decides to do what God wants him to do? And what we see in the history of Israel is the wisdom of man and all the problems it brings is unfolded for us. And that first man that was set up as king, his name was Saul. And we know the description back there in 1 Samuel chapter 8 is specifically for him. That's the kind of man he would be, and how heavily they'd be taxed, and how much they'd miss the days before that establishment of him as king because of how hard it would be. But he turned out to be a man as great and splendor as he seemed to be and hold. He turned out to be a man that just didn't love God enough. In chapter 13 of 1 Samuel, very early on in our introduction of Saul as the first king in Israel, we see that he does not submit to God's command to wait for that sacrifice to come with the priest that was Samuel, and this intimidation by the Philistines at that time, he offered up an unlawful sacrifice. And that's when God said, the kingdom will be taken from you and be given to another. And then in chapter 15, that's further solidified in his rebellion against God, when God said, utterly destroy the Amalekites for what they did to us when we came out of Egypt early on in the history of Israel. And you need to completely destroy them, leave nothing left. And he spared some of the best of the flocks, and of course, King Agag. And out of jealousy, we read that he continually sought David's life, a man who was after God's own heart. Then after David, we have David's son Solomon. And as great and wise as he was, and we read of that wisdom throughout the Proverbs and Ecclesiastes, he was a man who did exactly what God told him not to do and married foreign wives. And it wasn't that there was something wrong with the human race that was over here in this country. It was simply that they serve false gods, and if you marry them, you're going to be influenced to serve those false gods. And that's exactly what happened. A man as wise as Solomon turns away from the one and only true God because he decided to do exactly what God had told him not to do. After Solomon, you have his son Rehoboam. And we know the story of Rehoboam in 1 Kings chapter 12, where he sought the advice of the elders regarding the taxation of the rest of the nation of Israel. When Jeroboam came to him and asked to alleviate that taxation, take your heavy hand off of us. And instead of listening to the elders to do just that and preserve peace, he turned to his peers, and his peers said, no, make it harder on them. And so Jeroboam and Israel rebelled, and the kingdom was divided. And in that division, in 2 Chronicles 12 and verse 14, it records that Rehoboam did evil because he did not prepare his heart to seek the Lord, and it led to idolatry. And then when that kingdom was divided, Jeroboam and Israel were in the north. And Jeroboam was afraid that these people would now, in going to Jerusalem to worship, turn their hearts back to the house of David and Rehoboam. And instead of trusting in God then, he turned to idolatry. He set up high places in Dan and Bethel so people didn't have to travel all the way to Jerusalem to worship God. You could worship here with this image and here with this image. How convenient is that? Except that led them into rampant idolatry, which characterized the northern nation of Israel and then even touched Judah. And Israel was carried away into Assyrian captivity and Judah into Babylonian captivity. We need to learn from this that there's a consequence to all the choices we make. And the choices we make by our own wisdom often lead down a path of destruction like it did for the children of Israel. They said, we don't want your structure anymore, God. Make us a king like all the nations. And these are the kinds of kings that took the throne. People who did evil in the sight of the Lord. People that did not care about the law of the Lord. People that forgot where the law of the Lord was even located. We remember that with the young King Josiah, how he restored the temple, he restored the house of worship and found this dusty book of the law. Where was this? Where does this come from? And when they read it, he rent his clothes and he mourned because they were way off from God's standard. That's the kind of stuff that came about from man's wisdom. But we do know that not all of them were bad. We mentioned David, a man after God's own heart. But what David would stand as imperfect as he actually was, we know all the evil that he performed as well. Even though he was a man after God's own heart, David stood as a type of the one to come who would restore God's order among his people. And we see that in prophecy. The kingdom of prophecy was a theocratic monarchy. There is a king, but ultimately it's God that's on the throne. And that's what we see in 2 Samuel chapter 7 when God is talking through Nathan the prophet to David when he wants to build God a house because he lived in a house of cedar and God dwells in tents. And God said, I never asked you for that, but your son will do this. He said in verse 12 of 2 Samuel 7, when your days are fulfilled and you rest with your fathers, I will set up your seed after you who will come from your body and I will establish his kingdom. He shall build a house for my name and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. I will be his father and he shall be my son. If he commits iniquity, I will chasten him with the rod of men and with the blows of the sons of men. But my mercy shall not depart from him as I took it from Saul, whom I moved from before you. And your house and your kingdom shall be established forever before you. Your throne shall be established forever. Now, this is obviously found in its fulfillment when Solomon takes the throne and then he builds the house for the Lord. And there's the furthering of David's seed on that throne of Israel. But this is an obvious foreshadow of the seed of David to come in the Christ, who ultimately would be sitting on the throne forever. You see, Saul was promised an eternal throne so long as he obeyed the Lord. When he disobeyed the Lord in rebellion, God took it from him. And then David, a different family, a different man, took the throne. But with David, he said, it doesn't matter what happens, your throne will be established forever. There were evil kings in Judah that were reigning on the throne of David. And there were some good ones as well. But ultimately, that throne continued until Christ sat on that throne. That's what we read of in Isaiah, the 9th chapter, another prophecy of the Messiah and his kingdom, that unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government will be upon his shoulder. His name will be called Wonderful, Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and peace, there will be no end upon the throne of David and over his kingdom to order in and establish it with judgment and justice from that time forward, even forever. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will perform this. We see some interesting things about this too. That on the throne of David that was established way back there in 1 and 2 Samuel, he would reign. But he is called Mighty God, Everlasting Father. See, they rejected God and went after a man king. And God put into his motion the plan to set up God back on the throne in his son. That's exactly what we see fulfilled in Acts the 2nd chapter. He wouldn't sit on a physical throne. He sat on a throne in Acts 2. He received his kingdom. He was at the right hand of the throne of God. And the kingdom was established when men and women were baptized in the name of Christ for the remission of their sins. They were added to the church, which is the kingdom. And this is exactly what Peter preaches in Acts 2 and verse 25, when he quotes from the Psalms that David wrote, I foresaw the Lord always before my face. He is at my right hand that I may not be shaken. Therefore, my heart rejoiced and my tongue was glad. Moreover, my flesh also will rest in hope, for you will not leave my soul in Hades, nor will you allow your Holy One to see corruption. You have made known to me the ways of life. You will make me full of joy in your presence. Peter explains, men and brethren, let me speak freely to you of the patriarch David, that he is both dead and buried, and his tomb is with us today. Therefore, being a prophet, and knowing that God had sworn with an oath to him that of the fruit of his body, not his body, of the fruit of his body, according to the flesh, he would raise up the Christ to sit on his throne, he foreseeing this spoke concerning the resurrection of the Christ, that his soul was not left in Hades, nor did his flesh see corruption. This Jesus God has raised up, of which we are all witnesses. And it says in verse 34, that David further said in another psalm, the Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand till I make your enemies your footstool. He's saying now Jesus is king. God is king again. Now there is a true theocracy restored. And it's not by any physical means of a physical government reigning on the physical earth, but it's a spiritual government. And that's exactly what we see in the revelation of the New Testament of how our God in Jesus reigns on that throne. Consider Psalm 110, which I think is a key messianic psalm of the Old Testament, one that is most often quoted and alluded to in the New Testament. Of all prophecies of the Messiah, this one is the most often quoted and alluded to in the New Testament, and it's a very short psalm. The Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand till I make your enemies your footstool. The Lord shall send the rod of your strength out of Zion, rule in the midst of your enemies. Your people shall be volunteers in the day of your power, and the beauties of holiness from the womb of the morning. You have the dew of your youth. The Lord has sworn and will not relent. You are a priest forever according to the order of Melchizedek. The Lord is at your right hand. He shall execute kings in the day of his wrath. He shall judge among the nations. He shall fill up the places with dead bodies. He shall execute the heads of many countries. He shall drink of the brook by the wayside. Therefore, he shall lift up the head. And this is obviously a reference in its messianic nature to a spiritual kingdom. I want us to consider a few things that are importantly applied by Jesus himself to this messianic psalm, and understand how the kingdom of the Old Testament, which had a physical king that ultimately was the desire and a rejection of God and its establishment in 1 Samuel 8 by those who were of the children of Israel, how it pales in comparison to God's restored order and his eternal plan. In Matthew 22, in verses 41 through 46, Jesus turns the questions on the Pharisees and those surrounding them, when they had already questioned Jesus a few things, along with the Sadducees questioning about the resurrection. And it shows, among many other passages of the New Testament, their misunderstanding and their biases about this messianic kingdom. Jesus says to them in verse 42, what do you think about the Christ? Whose son is he? And they said to him, the son of David. And he said to them, how then does David in the Spirit call him Lord, saying? And he quotes Psalm 110 in verse 1. The Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand till I make your enemies your footstool. If David then calls him Lord, how is he son? And no one was able to answer him a word, nor from that day on did anyone dare question him anymore. Jesus is not saying here that he is not the son of David. He's saying he is not merely the son of David according to the flesh. Romans 1 says that that was established. Genealogy shows it. Matthew chapter 1 records that genealogy of Jesus, that he is indeed the son of David according to the flesh. He is that seed that was promised to be set up on the throne for eternity in 2 Samuel chapter 7, ultimately, as a messianic promise. But Jesus points out what they did not get. They should have understood it by necessarily implication in the Old Testament passage of Psalm 110 and verse 1, among others, but they didn't get it. They thought it would just be another ordinary man king, and that according to their original request in 1 Samuel 8. Jesus says, no, he's God. God will truly assume the throne according to this messianic promise. And so we already see God's ways are much greater than our ways, that it would be an infallible, eternal one, all-powerful one, that would assume the throne and government in this messianic kingdom. But we read something else in Psalm 110 concerning that king, because in verse 4 of Psalm 110, it talks about him being a high priest. The Hebrew writer looks to that in chapter 5 and verses 9 through 11, that having been perfected, Jesus became the author of eternal salvation to all who obey him, called by God as high priest according to the order of Melchizedek, of whom we have much to say and hard to explain since you have become dull of hearing. And he goes on in the rest of that chapter and the next chapter to show what he means by them being dull of hearing and not able to digest this meat. And then he picks back up in chapter 7 about that meat, about Jesus, the Christ, the Son of God, as king, also being a high priest. In verse 11, it explains the necessary transformation or change, rather, into a different law, because Christ could not be high priest under the law of Moses. If the perfection, verse 11 of chapter 7, were through the Levitical priesthood, for under it the people received the law, what further need was there that another priest should rise according to the order of Melchizedek and not be called according to the order of Aaron? For the priesthood being changed of necessity, there is also a change of the law. Now, that's necessary to have him as high priest, but there's also great benefit to that in other ways. And he explains, for he of whom these things are spoken belongs to another tribe from which no man has officiated at the altar. For it is evident that our Lord arose from Judah, of which tribe Moses spoke nothing concerning the priesthood. And it is yet far more evident in the likeness of Melchizedek, there arises another priest who comes not according to the law of a fleshly commandment, according to the power of an endless life, where he testifies from Psalm 110 and verse 4, you are a priest forever according to the order of Melchizedek. Notice this, for on the one hand there is an annulling of the former commandment because of its weakness and unprofitableness, for the law made nothing perfect. On the other hand, There is the bringing in of a better hope through which we draw near to God. This is what you want, Israel. These are my plans, though, that are far superior. Here, God would assume the throne once again, ultimately in the Son of God, Jesus. But as Jesus came from Judah, and he would be high priest as well as he's king, he had to be high priest after another order of Melchizedek, who was not only a king of Salem, but also a priest of God. And in the vast and deep wisdom of God, now God is sitting back on the throne, but not according to a law that kills, but now according to a law of grace that saves. And there is a high priest who was a man, but also God, so has the power to deliver us, but also the ability in his manhood to sympathize with us and aid us in whatever we need. You see the wisdom of God in that. Not just a man, but God. Not just the king, but a high priest. Not just any law, but the new law that is perfect and a law that saves. With a high priest and king who can sympathize with us and grant us the power, not just sympathy, but the power to help us overcome. I think that's important. And it's nothing that anyone under the Old Testament times could have ever fathomed. God didn't expect them to. He didn't fully reveal it to them. But if they had simply just trusted in God, not we want a man to rule over us, but we want God to rule over us. And it may have been, obviously, in the coming about of his plans that there would be a man eventually appointed king according to God's time. He makes all things good in his time. And then Christ would have come the same. But I think God shows us through this record of the good, the bad, and the ugly that man's ways pale in comparison to God's ways. Because Israel requested a king, and the history of those kings is primarily negative. And then through the second king, David, there would come in his lineage the ultimate king, the Messiah, who would reign on the eternal kingdom. God then assumed the throne again. He offers protection, provision, and ultimately salvation. And those in that kingdom don't question his rule. They don't request some other format, but they trust in God's government. And they trust that that's the best way. And Jesus calls us and invites us to the blessedness of such. Matthew 11:28, he says, "Come to me, all you who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and lowly in heart, and you will find rest for your souls, for my yoke is easy and my burden is light." He's talking about, let me reign over you as your king. Come into my kingdom and trust in my rule and my government. You'll find rest. That's where the victory lies. We need to understand about the nature of this kingdom, though. It's definitely a true theocratic monarchy, but it's not one which is on the earth. The Catholic Church got it all wrong. They tried to be a theocratic monarchy in all the earth. That's what they thought is world power. And now they dwell in the Vatican, and there is a theocratic monarchy there, but it's certainly not one according to the true God and his will. But this is not any physical representation of God on earth, but it's primarily spiritual in regard to its government. Jesus did not come up to set a kingdom of physical nature on this earth, but to establish a spiritual one that could not be defeated. In John 18, before Pilate, in verse 33, Jesus was questioned, and he was asked, "Are you the king of the Jews?" So Jesus answered Pilate, saying, "Are you speaking for yourself about this, or did others tell you this concerning me?" You see, Pilate's concerned with a physical kingdom. Pilate said, "Am I a Jew? Your own nation and chief priests have delivered you to me. What have you done?" And Jesus answered, notice this, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would fight so that I should not be delivered to the Jews. But now my kingdom is not from here." Pilate said, "Are you a king then?" He said, "You say rightly that I am a king. For this cause I was born, and for this cause I have come into the world, that I should bear witness to the truth. Everyone who hears, or who is of the truth, hears my voice." What Jesus is establishing is not only is his kingdom not physical, it's spiritual and therefore can be eternal, but my rule is through the truth. And that shows God's wisdom. How is he going to have the full rule in the universe, all the world, universal rule? Because truth is universal. And anyone who loves the truth and obeys the truth is under my rule. I'm their king. And that's all over the world. And that's why Jesus said in Luke 17 in verses 20 through 21, "The kingdom does not come with observation, nor will they say, 'See here or see there,' for indeed the kingdom of God is within you." That is, as you submit within your heart to Christ's rule and the truth, and you obey him, and you have faith in him, that's the kingdom of God. Paul said it this way in Galatians 2 and in verse 20. It is no longer, I've been crucified with Christ. It is no longer I who live, but Christ lives in me. And the life which I now live in the flesh, I live by faith in the Son of God who loved me and gave himself for me. Said, I died. I'm not living according to my rule or according to any rule of man. I'm not governing my life. I'm letting Christ take over. And he set up as king on my heart. That's why we're commanded in 1 Peter 3 and verse 15 to sanctify Christ as Lord in your hearts. He's saying Christ is king. There's no doubt about it. And he's going to judge each and every person in the end. But our duty is to allow him in our free will to submit ourselves to him, to yield ourselves to him, to let him gain control. The problem is many in the world, most in the world, do a similar thing to what the children of Israel did back in 1 Samuel chapter 8. And they say, God, this isn't good enough. We want a different king in control. And that king is not a physical man in the sense of sitting on a physical throne, but it is their own will and desire. In Philippians 3, in verse 18, Paul, by inspiration, speaks of the enemies of the cross of Christ, and he describes them a little further in verse 19, whose end is destruction, and whose God is their belly, and whose glory is in their shame, who set their mind on earthly things. He's saying their appetite, which is what the belly is put for by metonymy here, their fleshly appetite, their appetite for the things they set their mind on, earthly things, that rules their life as their God and as their king. God is not on the throne of their hearts, but they're serving themselves. And in reality, when we allow ourselves to govern our lives by our own fleshly appetite and earthly desires, and we are our own king or queen, really what we're doing is setting up Satan, the prince of the power of the air, on the throne of our heart. The Apostle Paul mentioned the past life of those he addressed in Ephesus in Ephesians 2 and verse 1. He said, you he made alive who were dead in trespasses and sins, in which you also once walked according to the course of this world, according to the prince of the power of the air, the spirit who now works in the sons of disobedience. That word prince is a Greek word which means a chief ruler, a magistrate, a prince, a ruler. It's speaking of a king. It's speaking of an authority. It's speaking of one who's in control. When the individuals turn aside to their own lust, they reject God as their king. They reject Christ as their king. And they set up not themselves as king. They think they're in control. But really, Satan is the one who is the king of their life. We've got to realize the vast wisdom of God and the power of his provision and protection. And we realize that and let him protect us as he's promised. Let him save us. Let him provide for us and let him gain control by submitting to the truth. That's what Jesus said in John 18. That's how I am a king. I reign through truth. And if we do that, we'll have the victory. That's ultimately what the Revelation is about. The last book of the New Testament, Revelation, is ultimately about in its general purpose that the people of God will gain victory because they submit to the all-powerful king that God set up on the throne. And in Revelation 17 and verse 14, it says that those enemies, those of the beast and those of those kings discussed, these will make war with the Lamb we know as Jesus, and the Lamb will overcome them. Why? For he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and those who are with him are called, chosen, and faithful. We'll overcome the evil one if we submit to Christ as king. And I want us to notice those who overcome are those who are described as called. And it's like Jesus did in Matthew 11. He calls us to that rest. He calls us to assume his yoke on our shoulders, to let him have control, to give him the power that God has given him himself by submitting to him in free will. They're called, and we're called, and we're chosen when we submit. But notice, and faithful. And it's not a word of just mere belief. It's a word of continuous action, of trustworthiness, of submitting to God in obedience. Strong comments on this word that is translated faithful, pistos. He says it's of persons who show themselves faithful in the transaction of business, the execution of commands, or the discharge of official duties. That's what the victory comes from, is doing our duty before our king, of executing the commands that he gives to us from heaven, of making sure we're always in submission to His ways. And we do that with the understanding of no matter what kind of contradictions comes from man's wisdom and how foolish we may seem to men, that God is sitting on the throne of our hearts and He's all powerful and He'll deliver us in the end. It didn't work for the Israelites to set up a different king, to reject God, to not trust Him and turn away to their own ways, and it won't work for us. Jesus' rule is without flaw. It's going to lead to ultimate victory, but rule He must. I was watching a short video the other day about all the political drama going on, and Nancy Pelosi talked about how she was a Catholic, and someone was suggesting she hated Trump. Don't tell me I hate Trump when I'm a Catholic and Catholics are raised to not hate. And the man was making the point that you're only a Catholic if you submit to the authority of the Catholic Church. And isn't that true? If you call yourself a Catholic, but you don't believe in what the Catholic Church is saying according to their catechism, are you really a Catholic? It's the same thing with a Baptist. If you call yourself a Baptist, but you disagree with the entire Baptist manual, you must not really be a Baptist. Well, if you call yourself a Christian, then you must, of necessity, if your words are true with your actions, submit to the law of Christ in totality. A person is not a Christian just by mere verbal profession. A person is a Christian by walking in the steps of Christ. And so people call Him their Lord. People call Him their King. Ironically, even though they believe the kingdom has not yet come, but they don't submit to His word. And that's no different than what the children of Israel did. They suggested they trusted in God, but they said, God, this government that You set up all the way back in Exodus 19 when You delivered us from the Egyptians and You gave us Your law on that mount, it's not good enough anymore. We want to be like all the other nations. They seem to have it together a little better. Monarchy seems like what it's all about, not theocracy. And chaos and violence and death and sin ensued. And so it will be if we reject Christ by disobeying His commands and following after the prince of the power of the air. What we need to do, if you haven't done it already this morning, is allow Him to gain that control and government and rule of your life by submitting to His commands. That's how it starts, by being baptized into His kingdom. He cannot have control over you if you are willingly outside of the borders of His kingdom. He has control over you as you allow Him to dictate what you do in your life. And that starts first by being baptized into His body, His kingdom, His church, for the remission of your sins. And we can assist you in that this morning if that's a desire you have. It may be that you have obeyed the gospel already, but you've not been letting Christ as King control your life. That is going to lead to eternal destruction. And Christ demands you to give Him control. And He's given you long suffering up to this point. And so if you've been in rebellion, you can come back to Him before it's everlastingly too late. And it may be that we can assist you with that here as well this morning. Whatever your spiritual need is, we invite you to come forward while we stand and sing the song that was selected.